Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
The following show has a lot of explicit content. I'm sure you'll like it because of that. It's Thursday, July 7th, 2022. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. No Mo Bojo, as the UK's PM takes an extremely unsubtle hint from the mass resignations of his ministers, and he acquiesces he will be stepping down as head of the Conservative Party and therefore, well, actually hanging around in free public housing, the council flat known as 10 Downing Street. The BBC's Rob Watson has more.
The political crisis this morning was what would happen about the standoff between Boris Johnson and the Conservative Party. Well, he has lost that standoff. But now we're into, well, does he stay until there's a new leader, or does there need to be an interim leader? And obviously the problem that Boris Johnson faces is that there are many in his party who think, well, hang on a minute, if we're getting rid of him because he's unfit for high office, we don't think he's truthful, we don't trust his judgment, why would you leave him there any longer than absolutely necessary? But he seems to be you wouldn't be surprised to hear this, are rather determined to stay.
Boris Johnson ultimately backing Remain. How about that? I never loathed Boris Johnson as much as I was meant to, as dictated by all the right-thinking Brits. I suppose it's that I wasn't exposed to the posh boys of Eton and Oxford sneering at me all those years, so I haven't the reflexive revulsion to a ridiculous toff that your garden variety Brit might possess. I know enough to use the word tough, but I don't feel oppressed by the toughs. Johnson seemed like an opportunistic, self-serving, thoroughly dishonest operator whose great gift was to let you in on the idea that he wasn't pretending to be anything that he wasn't. Wasn't pretending to be anything close to honest, especially honest. But from the keenest observers of English politics, who I credit, I understand that Boris had another great trick, which was to blind you to the fact that he was operating on a level even beyond what I observed. So when I looked at Johnson, I saw something like, yes, yes, I'm saying these words, but no, no, I don't mean it. And aren't we both clever because we both know it? But the next layer was something like, absolute disdain for anyone who actually could have ideals or scruples, a disdain paired with casual cruelty. Maybe I didn't pick this up because it wasn't my interests or my country that he was selling out. Perhaps I give him, I don't know, 10% more credit than he deserves as a clever person because of his accent, because of the contrast to the vulgar American president who was once his ally. Maybe I think Partygate seems like kind of weak beer generally, or that he seemed to have overseen the vaccine rollout, not terribly. He seemed to have engineered Brexit, which I don't support, but if it's the policy, might as well do it right rather than wrong. Seemed to do that better than his two predecessors. Of course, I pay attention to British politics out of interest and curiosity, not out of duty and dependence. So Boris is stepping down, but not leaving, quite possibly because he already reserved his wedding reception at the Chequers estate, and he wouldn't have access to that if he weren't prime minister. To me, that's laughable. To his countrymen, maybe it's closer to tragic. When you go to the circus, you want to see a clown. When the circus becomes your country, it is a lot less delightful. On the show today, I spiel about two GoFundMes and what they tell us about what we already know. And I will say in the show notes, if the spiel touches you or you are interested in the details, in the show notes, I've put a link to a Washington Post article that I talk about and a GoFundMe, which I have confirmed is legitimate and the money will go to the people who they say it's going to. But first, the January 6th committee is looking into the Trump presidency and the words he used to incite violence on that day. One expert they called on to submit evidence joins me next. She's Jennifer Murcia, historian of American political rhetoric at Texas A&M, and author of Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. The Rhetorical Insight of Professor Jennifer Murcia, up next.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Past investigations into presidents included the question, what did the president know and when did he know it? Our current investigation is more organized around the dual question of what did the president say and how did he mean it? So much of the either prosecution or just public accounting comes down to Trump's state of mind, his mens rea, when he said different things publicly and different things privately. An interesting, I'm going to say fascinating insight into what the meaning of these words are is provided by Jen Murcia, who is a historian of American political rhetoric at Texas A&M. She's the author of the book Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. And she revealed on her Twitter feed recently that the January 6th Commission has talked to her about the words, presumably the words that Trump said and how he meant them to be taken and how we should understand them to be taken. I want to get into what her testimony before the committee is, but also what her insight into all of this that they have revealed thus far is. Jen, welcome back to The Gist.
It's my pleasure.
So you tell me, did someone from Washington, D.C., did Liz Cheney show up on your phone one day and you said, wait a minute, shouldn't this say scam likely? How did the commission reach out to you to call your insight?
So it was not Liz Cheney, but there is a team of researchers who are working with the committee, assisting with, you know, the whole process. And so I was contacted, and a number of scholars who work on right-wing authoritarianism, fascism, you know, different things about the internet, just, you know, all of that kind of stuff. We were all sort of contacted, and they asked for us to, based on our research that we'd already done, to, you know, sort of write they call it a statement for the record. So I wrote about Trump's rhetoric. I wrote about his rhetoric leading up to his election in 2016. I wrote about his rhetoric during his presidency and then leading up to January 6th and then on January 6th.
How did they frame the assignment? What was the prompt?
Yeah, I think it was something like, write what you think would be helpful or informative for the committee. It was very, very little direction.
And so you just went with what you presumed, assumed, thought they might want?
Yeah. And as a rhetorician, yeah. Right? Like, that's a fun thing to do, is to think about, like, what would be useful for me to say in this circumstance? What would be helpful for them to understand? But also thinking about the multiple audiences, because it's both the committee, but then also they wanted it to be written in a non-scholarly way for the public. And so thinking about what does the public mm-hmm. need to know? What would persuade the public to understand, you know, Trump's rhetoric and how it works,
right.
And how can I explain this simply?
So I know much of what you've written, and I've read your books, and we've talked many times, But what parts of, so maybe not everyone listening to this interview knows all the background, but what did you think was most important for both the committee to know and the lay public to know about how Trump uses words and language and how that might advance our understanding of what he was actually doing?
Yeah, so I really focused as an overview on kind of two points. One, that Trump's rhetoric is anti-democratic, and second, that it is war rhetoric, as the sort of overview of what I wanted them to understand. And then I showed how that works, how he uses conspiracy theory, how he denies facts that are he knows are true, and circulates facts, well, not facts, but circulates conspiracy that he knows are not true, how he dodges accountability when you question him on those things directly, how he uses ad hominem, right, which is attacking the person rather than their argument, how he uses ad baculum, which is threats of force and intimidation.
As you were talking about how he conveys truth, how he dodges questions, you weren't trying to convey that he dodges accountability. You literally were going through how he does this, what his method
is. Yeah, are. Yeah. So I've never done this before, but I tried to figure out a way, again, to like explain how I see when I see things from, you know, as a rhetoric expert. And so I essentially like diagrammed paragraphs and sentences and interviews, to just sort of like underline, okay, this is him using a paralipsis. And then sort of like on the side, this is why he's doing that here. This is why, you know, you can't hold him accountable because he does that, to just try to, you know, sort of explain all of it. I tried to show how, like in the Mueller report, when you read that, you hear him putting pressure on his attorney general using paralipsis, right? Like, it'd be good for you if you unrecused yourself. I'm not going to tell you to unrecuse yourself, but it would be good if you did. The country would really appreciate it, that kind of thing. And then I showed how in his speech at the Ellipse, he used war rhetoric, right? So what has historically been used by presidents to lead the nation to war, right? Well-established set of, you know, things that presidents do, but also, you know, world leaders throughout history have done. Donald Trump did all of those things on January 6th in that speech.
Could you give us an example, perhaps as tangible example as you choose, of it seems like he's saying X, but he's really saying Y, or maybe, you know, 10 degrees off of X?
He tweeted something, and then he was asked at a primary debate, about the tweet. And they explicitly read the tweet to him and said, you know, does this show good characters? Does this show good judgment? And he was like, that's not what it says, you know, but it was read like word by word. Well, no, that's not what that meant. Right. Like, and so he's able to, again, define things to his advantage just by denying that it means what, you know, it would be taken to mean. And it's one of his, you know, it's one of his key strategies is to try to manipulate meanings of words, to try to manipulate understanding, and to essentially bully his way through so that, you know, you just accept whatever it is that he wants you to accept. It's coercion, not persuasion.
Do you think he's inexact with words? I mean, there are times where it seems like he's really inexact with words. Sometimes I give him too much credit. Like, he does say everything and its opposite. He does say fight for Trump, but he also says peacefully protest. What's going on there?
I think he's actually pretty careful with his words. I know it seems random and it seems like it's chaos. But, you know, when you study him carefully over time and you watch him, you know, deliver campaign rally speeches over and over again, what you see is that he is very good at audience adaptation. He's very good at changing what he says to fit the moment. He doesn't always use, you know, the sort of biggest rhetorical guns. He doesn't always use an ad baculum. He doesn't use a threat necessarily unless he needs to. You know, he kind of keeps that in his back pocket. One of the things that I wrote about in my book that I thought was so fascinating was that he didn't actually say lock her up about Hillary Clinton very often at all, two times maybe. But he was able to force the audience to chant lock her up regularly, right? And so,
Which has, by the way, the same cadence as hang Mike Pence.
Right, and you can't hold him accountable because he didn't say hang Mike Pence, but he provoked his audience to say, hey, Mike Pence, right? Or lock her up.
And in both instances, he said absolutely nothing to contradict that.
That's right. Well, so that's not true. I don't know about the Mike Pence one, but for Hillary Clinton, he would say, nah, let's just beat her in November.
Right.
And then after he won, he said, ah, she's been through enough. You know, that played well before the election, but we don't need to say that now. You know, in the sort of brief interim where he thought, oh, I won and everyone's going to be nice to me now. And then they weren't nice to him. So then he started saying it again. But
so is that demagogic to say now, let's just beat her in November? It seems to me that really can be interpreted. A good faith interpretation can be he, of course, likes to inspire passions, but when pressed, we'll say you've gone too far. I don't know. I could think of like John McCain saying, no, Barack Obama is not a Muslim. He's a good American. I mean, it's not exactly the same. It's not like John McCain, there were a chance of he's a Muslim at John McCain rallies, but it does seem kind of parallel to him actually saying the right thing in the moment.
Yeah. And that was one of the things that I found so interesting, because he would do a parallel case and he would say, you know, this Republican was charged with this crime and they got a jail sentence. But Hillary Clinton, she got away, you know, with everything. And she always does. She's crooked Hillary. And then he would prompt them to say, lock her up. Right. So that's completing the enthymeme. Right. It's completing the syllogism of the argument. And using the parallel case structure to do it.
Yeah.
So it was
basically
smart
he's reading the first four lines of a limerick
and then
half
like
of the fifth line and they know where to take it. Yeah.
And so then they say it and then he goes, nah, right? And so, I mean, think of the show, right? Like he prompts them to do this very energizing thing that they love to do. They do it. And then he gets to be, you know, pretend to be benevolent and judicious by saying, nah, nah, nah.
Trump was a very successful politician, continues to be. Do you see these rhetorical devices being used more by maybe others who might run for president?
Yeah. You know, I don't know if you asked me this in 2016, but I suspect you did. And I'm going to change my answer now. So I think back then I said, no, Trump is an anomaly. Like no one else could get away with doing, you know, what Trump does, because other people can be shamed, right? Which is community censure, and Trump is immune from that. But what I've realized, sadly, is that the way that the media environment works is that there is no like possibility for community censure or shame, because what is derided in one community on the left or the mainstream is celebrated on the right. And so, you know, what appears to be shameful on one side is not on the other. I mean, and it works in the reverse too. So like John Cornyn, you know, working on the gun bill and then getting booed at the Texas Republican convention is an example of it working in the reverse.
The reverse being them shaming him for not being authoritarian.
Right. They're like, yeah. What? You want to work to destroy our gun rights? Like, that's not good. We don't like that.
So Hugo Chavez is a left-wing authoritarian. There are others. In America, at least right now, is there no evidence that left-wing authoritarianism is being embraced, or do you think it's even possible given where our politics are?
That's such a great question. There's a strong academic debate about whether it's possible to have a left-wing authoritarian regime or even personality. So typically, authoritarianism is associated with right-wing personalities. Right. When they ask the questions like how you raise your kids and all that stuff, and that's supposed to equal the authoritarian personality scale, they tend to be right wing. But there is research that supports that there is left wing authoritarians. I've been looking for them, frankly, because I'm writing a book right now on autocrats and I wanted to include left wing autocrats in it. But I haven't been able to find really great examples of that. You know, and so I was thinking that it was something.
Do you mean within America or even in the world? Like my example of Chavez.
Yeah. I think in America, like so I think left-wing authoritarianism would be something like we need to violently destroy the established political, social, and economic structures, right? Mm-hmm. In America.
So the phrase smash the state doesn't fit the bill?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, right? Like if there's like a, so, but when you look at like anarchist discourse. Like, it's like, no, we want it to be democratic. Like, it's, you know, and so it's not necessarily so violent. And so that's where I don't know. Maybe you know great examples. I haven't been able to find them. But theoretically, they exist.
Yes, yes. I do know that it's not parallel what the Republicans will point to extreme rhetoric by, say, their, you know, their hated figure of the moment, could be a member of the squad, could be, you know, some local politician. And it's never authoritarian by it's never the definition, which we could change, but it's never the definition of authoritarian, right?
Right.
It's usually anti-elite, which isn't authoritarian.
Right. Or it's just or they want to claim something is authoritarian because it's like policing, you know, how people talk or something like that, or, you know, what a gender is, you know, and they want to call that authoritarian. But I mean, technically, in terms of the definitions of those words, by, you know, scholars and people who know stuff and don't have necessarily a political agenda.
So, under, from what I understand, the Brandenburg rule, which is incitement to violence, what he said didn't lead to incitement to violence as the law understands it. But even if, I'll give you a hypothetical, let's say after the speech and you had a real good understanding. Maybe
Wait,
that
do people
you did,
really think that? Because I don't think that. I think he did incite violence.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is this is the debate, but under the Brandenburg standard, it's very hard to tie what he said
no,
to direct incitement.
No, but I think that's
violence.
Not. I think it's clear.
Oh yeah, well, tell me why.
Well, because of what he did, because he incited violence, right?
Well,
because
it
he
did
said,
happen.
Yeah, I mean, he used war rhetoric,
yeah.
Right? Like, so he used war rhetoric. He said over and over and over again in the speech, he said, something that is rightfully yours has been taken from you. Your innocent victims, they are corrupt and evil. They're not even human. Fight like hell. You can't not fight. You have to fight. Fight like hell. Fight, fight, fight. Go fight. We're going to go walk down and fight together, right? Like, it was absolutely,
right, yeah.
I mean, that's war rhetoric. So I don't know how that's not, like, I don't know how that wouldn't pass the Brandenburg rule.
If you had to rewrite the paper now, knowing what you know from what the rest of us know from seeing the committee's operations, is there any different, is there any different information you'd put in there or different things you'd emphasize?
No, I've been really impressed with the narrative that they've created. And how well it has fit with what I wrote. I hear them using phrases that are exactly the same or similar to what I wrote, which is probably a coincidence. I'm sure I didn't have that much of an influence on the committee. But yeah, I've felt like what I said was probably the most useful thing I could say. I'll be able to release it after they're done with their hearings, I'm told. So you can read it and see what you think.
Dr. Jennifer Murcia is a historian or an historian, depending on how you pronounce the H, of America.
It's so controversial.
It is the most. Of everything we've talked about, the indefinite article before historian is the third rail. Of American political rhetoric at Texas A&M, her latest book, excellent book, Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. She's tried to educate the committee on her findings about the demagoguery of our former president. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
And now the spiel. Have you heard the story of 2-year-old Aiden McCarthy? You might not immediately recognize the name, but you probably know who he is. Both of Aidan's parents, his mother Irina, his father Kevin, were killed by the Highland Park gunman. Afterward, the little boy was walking in the street saying, "Mommy, Daddy." He was picked up and protected by strangers, then taken to a fire station where his grandfather collected the newly orphaned toddler. The GoFundMe for Aidan says, "Aidan will be cared for by his loving family, and he will have a long road ahead to heal, find stability, and ultimately navigate life as an orphan. He's surrounded by a community of friends and extended family that will embrace him with love and any means available to ensure he has everything he needs as he grows. As of this broadcast, over 55,000 people have given. The total is $2.9 million, over $2.9 million. The top giver is Bill Ackman, famous hedge fund investor. The New York Post put his name in a headline, as did USA Today. Billionaire donates $18,000 as top funder for a two-year-old who lost parents in Highland Park shooting. 55,000 people donating nearly $3 million shows how gut-wrenching a story this is. But $3 million means that this child and his caregivers will not ever want for anything that money can buy. Their profound wants and needs will be for that which money can never buy. Generally, people donate. For a few reasons, the most high-minded is altruism, the most craven include tax advantages and social cachet. But the most common reason people donate to charity is to make themselves feel better. And that's fine. That's not an indictment. It's kind of a tribute to humanity that to feel suffering in others prompts the need to alleviate it in ourselves. Mass shootings make people feel terrible about their communities, their country, the youth of our country, our fellow citizens who've been senselessly victimized. So it's good that Aidan and his family are getting assistance and a message of care. Aidan's family deserves the outpouring as much as the little boy did not deserve the cruelty that he right now cannot understand. You know, none of us can really understand it. That's Aidan. Here's Kaylee and Kavan. 3 months ago, the Washington Post ran a story titled, "Orphaned by Gun Violence, Two Kids, Two Shootings, Two Parents, Gone." Subhead, "Every day in America, more than 40 children lose a parent to shootings. New Post data reveals Kaylee and Kavan Washington lost both." There's a GoFundMe page for Kaylee and Kavan that their aunt took out. It says, "Hi, I'm Vernell. I started a GoFundMe page because my sister, Jacqueline Burley, was brutally murdered, shot 9 times in broad daylight on 2/23/20 on the streets of Baltimore. As of today, no one's been arrested. She's cherished by a host of family and friends, but most of all, two children, Kavan and Kaylee Washington, of which I'm the guardian of her youngest, Kaylee, whom witnessed bits and pieces of her murder. This tragedy has caused Kaylee to suffer from mental illnesses such as PTSD, social anxiety, and depression." The GoFundMe had a goal of $10,000, and in the 3.5 months it's been up, it has raised $305. This isn't to shame or criticize anyone whose heart went out to Aidan McCarthy. If we all knew the story of Kaylee and Kavan, I'm sure we'd be saddened as well. If the story dominated our feeds and screens, and if that story were made salient, our hearts would surely hurt. But we're not invested in the story of Kaylee and Kavan as we were in the story of Aidan. We're seldom engaged in the usual story of parentless children who lost a mother or father to gun violence.
A violent night in Kern County that left two people dead and children without their parents.
So we know 4 out of those 7 children lost their parents.
Barnes, a new father, leaving behind a 9-month-old daughter.
He leaves behind a young son and daughter.
She leaves behind a daughter and son, ages 7 and 11.
There are, of course, differences in Aidan's story and that of these other children. Many of these children have a surviving parent in their life. The generosity of the public might be affected by the perceived culpability of the parents in their own deaths. There's the shock of a random killing at a parade versus the grim predictability of shootings in high-crime neighborhoods. And then there's race. Of course there's race. John Woodrow Cox wrote the Washington Post story where I read about Kavan and Kaylee. It was part of a larger series about children of gun violence. The paper reports that black people make up just 30% of the residents of the 20 cities the Post analyzed. But of the children in those cities, meaning 3,600 of whom whose parents were killed by gun violence in just 20 cities, 82% were black. Am I saying that if Aiden had been a black or Latino boy, there would be no outpouring of grief and funds? I am not. I think there would have been sympathy had that been the profile of a boy orphaned in a high-profile mass shooting. Of course, unlikely, given that Highland Park is 84.7% non-Hispanic white, according to the latest census figures. When the victims of unusual shootings are black or Latino, there is attention and tears and donations. Think of Buffalo and Charleston, South Carolina, where it wasn't just the case that the victims were all African American. They were specifically targeted because they were black. I think the mostly white children of Sandy Hook and the mostly Hispanic children of Uvalde, Texas, equally anguished America. My point isn't as simple as white victims sympathetic, minority victims unsympathetic. It is that mass shootings grip our imagination and that usual shootings don't. And the whys of that might also be because of racism. Black people make up 13% of the population and 62% of the gun homicide victims in 2020, according to CDC stats. These are the usual killings. The definitions of mass shootings change a lot. You could credibly say there have been over 100 mass shootings since Uvalde. Washington Post does say this. Or you could say that Highland Park, that shooting was just the second after Uvalde. The Violence Project says this. But whatever the definition, the kind of shooting that gets national news and New York Times push alerts and wall-to-wall coverage and calls for new laws and that Onion article that shames and stalks us, they are the atypical 1%. The victims are very different from the usual victims. The dynamics are different. The motives of the shooters are different. The weaponry is different. We're focusing over 90% of our attention on one kind of horrible, trauma-inducing, worthy of outrage shooting, and under 10% of our attention on the typical phenomenon. And it's not that the typical, usual shootings aren't troubling or saddening. It's that we're just so used to it. So it isn't news. It doesn't grip us. It's the rule, not the exception. One is the status quo. The other is the horrific outlier. And habituation to the status quo is simply how the status quo works. Are we indifferent to the usual victims of usual gun violence? Well, $300 for Kaylee versus $3 million for Aiden says to some degree we are. But we're also uncomfortable with the implications of focusing on the usual incidents, because the usual offenders come from the same community as the victims. I've talked about this before, but progressive sentiment is to de-emphasize if it bleeds, it leads. But if it doesn't lead, it gets ignored. Now, of course, there are ways to tell the story of gun violence offenders that emphasize the societal forces coming into play that drive someone towards violence or desperation or the even rational perception that you have to take self-defense into your own hands, which means a gun. There are ways to tell this story if we take care and ask the audience for their attention and lay out the explanations and the interconnecting forces over many pages, citing much scholarship. But to put that up against an emaciated, face-tattooed embodiment of dysfunction who planned his attack with the specific purpose of gaining attention, there's no contest. Paying attention, a lot of attention, to mass killings is in fact the right thing to do. We should not be inured. But overwhelming evidence shows the usual killings are happening, and often side by side and with greater casualty counts than the very shootings that get all of us to pay attention. Here now, this report from a very large city to the south of the very safe suburb where the 4th of July mass shooting killed 7 and injured 38.
This shooting brings the number of people shot since early Friday night in Chicago to at least 51. One of the youngest wounded was just a 10-year-old boy. And again, from this number, 51 people who were shot over the course of this weekend, 7 people died from their injuries.
The updated numbers are 10 dead, 62 wounded. Everything is stacked against the usual victim, from the imperatives of our attention to the limitation of our laws. Nothing can prevent children from being affected or even orphaned. Now, we did bring murder down once, and we can conceivably do it again, though it will be harder this time with recent Supreme Court rulings acting as an accelerant for gun violence. In the meantime, we just get used to it, which means knowing something so much that you kind of stop knowing it. Here now, as quoted by WBFF Baltimore, is the cousin of Kaylee Washington, the then 7-year-old girl who saw her mother murdered.
They doing a little stronger than expected. They lost their father a couple of years ago. So I'm not gonna say it's like, they just kind of already experienced this kind of situation. So they handled it a little better as a child would do if it was their first time ever losing a parent.
By the time you hear this, the GoFundMe for Aiden will have exceeded $3 million. Kaylee's is still at $305. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara is the GIST assistant producer. Joel Patterson, the GIST senior producer. Michelle Pesca, COOs this Peachfish production of ours. The GIST is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu, Gperu, Duperu, and thanks for listening.